Cool. So thank you so much for joining me today to have this chat. I really appreciate it. I've been following your work for a while, and I really loved the research you did on Sandy Hook. I think a lot of people are just too afraid to go there. But you know, if you're a truth seeker and you want to know the truth about things, you have to investigate everything. And you know, if you're wrong, you move on, and that's life. But I think it's really important to examine everything and to ask lots of questions. And you know, if the truth is there, it won't fear being investigated or looked into. So thanks again for joining me. And last time we chatted real briefly, I was thinking that we'd, you know, talk about some of the Sandy Hook research you've done and the connections to the Baha'i faith, but then you brought up to me some of the new research that you've been doing, and this just seems like we should take our conversation in that direction, because it's very, very interesting. It's not really being talked about, and it seems to be the final plan for the human species. So I thought maybe we could get into some of the post-genderism research that you've been doing, as well as the wireless research you've been looking into and how that's affecting our reproduction, our fertility, and just what these people in power have in store for us or what they are planning. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. I was really fascinated by some of the things you were telling me when we spoke last week about the effects of wireless on females' eggs. And so maybe you could, we could start off with post-genderism and this paper that you shared with me. You didn't write it yourself, obviously, but this is a big agenda that I've seen slowly making its way into the mainstream consciousness. And if you don't agree with, you know, abolishing gender roles and traditional gender roles, you are just evil and you want to oppress everyone and you're a hater. So.
Yeah, you know, first of all, thank you for inviting me to interview with you. And
Absolutely.
I really am interested to make more contact with people who are a little younger than I am, who have this kind of, you know, unstoppable curiosity and who can end up being broad dot connectors themselves. I have to say that I cringe when I hear the word research, like I've been doing lots and lots of deep research. I really have a, you could say, a small amount of knowledge about a lot of things. And sometimes it's good to have just a little knowledge because that will make you connect dots more easily than having tons of knowledge only in one subject, you know?
Oh,
And
absolutely. I agree.
yeah, so I've been able to just very, you know, I don't know if it's serendipity or this was what I was supposed to do, this is my life mission, but bring certain things together for other people. And always I seem to be traveling around in my own head. And I also can remember things that I hear or read to some extent, which is very helpful. And so when I come across something and it reminds me of something else I read about some other subject, but the two seem to fit, then I have to just go away and plumb that in my own head and figure out, okay, how does this relate to that? And I see a connection, and then all this other stuff starts to make sense. And I don't know, I mean, when you've done that, you know what I'm talking about. Otherwise, I sound like I'm just dippy, right?
Yeah,
But,
but it does make sense.
you know, there has been a tremendous, huge number of agendas all over the social fabric for many, many years. All these different groups, and they lobby and they want these rights and those rights. And the average person may not be part of a group per se, but I think this actually came out of the protocols of the Elders of Zion. I was reading excerpts from that, and they said that they wanted to create all these different political groups, and each group would want its own freedoms and rights, and it would get to the point where the average American would just say, okay, just give them what they want. I just don't want to hear about it, you know? And
Yeah.
we, I mean, the progression from, you know, let's liberate women. First, let's have them smoke. This is good.
Right.
This liberates them, you know. And then also getting them to vote, getting them to join the workplace. I have to make a connection here that will probably make you jump out of your chair. But it's another one of my wild dots that are brought together. I have to say that the circumcision of American men began rampantly in the 50s. And that, coupled with buxom secretaries in the workplace, is another factor that has gouged into the family, the solidness of families. And pushed.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Because that's another subject that someday we could get into, or we can get into it a little bit today. The effects of circumcision on male sexuality,
mm-hmm.
very, very pronounced. And so,
absolutely.
You know, so when you study how you bring women into the workplace and you say you're liberating them, and then you make men work with them all day, and these women are young and pretty, and they're all about, you know, dressing for work, looking nice, then it became called looking professional. And it's gotten to the point where you go into a workplace and people are wearing the scantiest, wildest stuff.
Yeah, I can definitely vouch for that. I see some women wearing stripper shoes, you know, going into the office, and it's completely accepted now. It's very strange.
Yeah, and Victoria's Secret catalog has a huge number of clothes that you can wear to the office that are exactly the sort of harlot style. But anyway, so they have brought the sexes in some ways more and more powerfully together, and in other ways they've split them apart. And after we got women's rights, then we got homosexuality was a subject in people's minds, gay rights. Then lesbians said, no, wait, we're not gay men, we're gay women. And then you had the bisexuals come out and say, well, wait, we're different from those guys. We can go both ways. And then you have the hermaphrodites who say, wait, we are not the same as any of those people. We're kind of a mix. And then you have the people who change genders, and eventually everyone wants their own bathroom, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, we're seeing this today in full force. It's not even LGBTQ, it's LGBTQP, then like the number 2. I mean, they've added multiple letters and numbers after, and it just keeps going.
Right. And then the answer is, let's just give everybody the same bathroom, and everybody will just learn to live with everyone else. And, you know, that'll make it simple. But this paper by Hughes and Dvorsky was written in 2008, Postgenderism Beyond the Gender Binary. And it talks about it. These two people, Dvorsky and Hughes, are from the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies in Hartford, Connecticut, which is not that far from Sandy Hook, right?
Yep.
And it is, I mean, I could read you the abstract. Maybe I should do that, because that gives people an idea for where this paper is going. But you can Google it. Postgenderism, that's one word, : beyond the gender binary, B-I-N-A-R-Y. So the abstract is, postgenderism is an extrapolation of ways that technology is eroding the biological, psychological, and social role of gender, and an argument for why the erosion of binary gender will be liberatory. Postgenderists argue that gender is an arbitrary and unnecessary limitation on human potential, and foresee the elimination of involuntary biological and psychological gendering in the human species through the application of neurotechnology, biotechnology, and reproductive technologies. Postgenderists contend that dyadic gender roles and sexual dimorphisms are generally to the detriment of individuals and society, Assisted reproduction will make it possible for individuals of any sex to reproduce in any combinations they choose, with or without mothers and fathers. And those words are in quotes, by the way, mothers and fathers. And artificial wombs will make biological wombs unnecessary for reproduction. Greater biological fluidity and psychological androgyny will allow future persons to explore both masculine and feminine aspects of personality. Postgenderists do not call for the end of all gender traits or universal androgyny, but rather that those traits become a matter of choice. Bodies and personalities in our post-gender future will no longer be constrained and circumscribed by gendered traits, but enriched by their use in the palette of diverse self-expression.
Wow.
So you get to choose. Do you want to be a man, an aggressive man, a feminine man, a man with, you know, I can't even go beyond that. That's as my brain is right now, having just...
Yeah. Go ahead. Well, what doesn't make sense to me, they want to abolish all gender roles. But then what they do is say a child identifies with feminine objects or ideas. They'll then say, oh, well, you can have those things and do those things, but you're still gender neutral. But they're choosing from the two gender norms. So I don't know if I worded that well enough for anyone to understand, but it doesn't quite make sense to me because they're still choosing from these two things, princesses or soldiers. You know, so if they really wanted to abolish all gender norms, they would be creating something new or coming up with some other kind of norm. But what they're doing is just mixing it all together and mashing it up into this confused neutral gender, what they like to call it. So it doesn't quite make sense to me.
That's because I think we're just on the road to what they're eventually going to create. I mean, they're not telling us everything right now. But when you give people the smorgasbord, that's all part and parcel of Hegelian dialectic. And you make them think that they are the ones in control of the choice making.
Right.
No.
Right. Exactly. And so, this paper – oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
This paper was written in 2008, and I'm already seeing a lot of this going on. Maybe we haven't, you know, started using artificial wombs frequently. I'm sure that they have been used for animals and for research. But I do see, obviously, IVF, you know, surrogates, egg donors. This is already happening. A same-sex couple can, you know, pay a woman a large sum of money to be artificially inseminated with their sperm or a donor's sperm, and the woman will carry the child, birth the child, and then give this child up to, you know, two women or two men. And this is completely accepted. When I speak out against this and say, hey, wait a second, you know, let's think about the child. How do they feel about this? This might be traumatic for them. I am called a homophobe. I'm called, you know, I have some kind of agenda. I'm a hater. But there are multiple studies that have come out saying that IVF babies are suffering from severe depression, from mental disorders, that they feel lost. And it only makes sense. I mean, we're not supposed to be conceived in a petri dish. I just think that's really messing with nature and messing with the spirits of humans coming to this realm, if you want to call it that.
Well, first of all, I just want to know who calls you a hate-filled person and prejudice.
Well,
just comments that you get.
Yeah, I'm actually part of a perinatal psychology group forum on Facebook where we discuss certain topics regarding the psychology before birth and after birth. And I simply asked on this forum, I said, are there any studies that anyone knows of involving same-sex couples and IVF babies and their, you know, following them as they grow up? Is there depression? Are there mental disorders. And I said at the end, because I can see how this could be traumatic for a child. And I mean, they just chewed me up. Like, all of them were saying, why are you in here? What's your agenda? And then they took a look at my Facebook page, where I have some anti-feminist propaganda saying, you know, tradition over feminism. I am not a feminist. And it was as if I to not be a feminist on top of.
And he had sort of a subspecialty in his practice. And that was to help women get pregnant, in the sense that he had figured out that the human body doesn't release eggs, the female ovulatory, process doesn't actually work if the person is too stressed out or has negative circumstances going on of one kind or another. So you have to remember that I read this somewhere, and it's hard for me to believe, but the chances of conceiving, when you consider that the fertility of women is about 3 days after they ovulate, that's how long the egg is ripe, quote unquote, in the fallopian tube, and then it's just kind of released and drifts into the uterus and dies off, and then you have the menstrual cycle beginning. But the chances of pregnancy are, under normal circumstances, 4 in 100. I read this when I was a teenager. It's very low, really. So that, I mean, that's, you know, if you just take into account having sex any time of day, anywhere, with anyone, that all the things that could work into it. So the body will not even release eggs if there's too much negative situation going on, just to put it simply. So my friend found that there were a lot of women turning to in vitro fertilization because they couldn't conceive with their husbands. Yes. And he determined, he would ask them, you know, questions and do some tests. He practiced Chinese medicine. So between asking them to start lightening up on the stress load that they had in their lives, whether it came from work or other emotional things, they were directed by him, you've really got to manage your stress. Then you've got to change your diet and start eating a whole lot better, with better nutrition and so forth, better sleep schedule. And then on top of that, he gave them acupuncture and Chinese herbs. And do you know, he had a very high rate of success with these women. And he was getting women who had already paid for IVF, and it was very expensive and it hadn't worked, and they were basically brushed off by the medical world, research world, and told to go and adopt. That's it. That's your only choice now, adoption. So when they were able to conceive naturally under his, with his assistance through this Chinese medicine and it's funny. It sounds like he did it, but no, he had so many grateful husbands who, I mean, they became his best friends and all that, because that's a big deal when you can help somebody have a child. So that got me thinking that, okay, so human biology is really very fragile, all things considered. And the womb has to be a really good, sound, it has to offer a good, sound environment for the development of that baby. And so now I'm going to get into the wireless issue, because on the way to that, we've already seen fertility drop in women and men, and it has to do with challenges. I would call them toxicity challenges that people have faced, from which their bodies are not functioning optimally, okay? And that makes sense to me. It's like the body has, I call it the biopsyche. It has its own brain that is rooted in its functionality, and it knows when things aren't optimal, and it will not do certain things if the conditions of your life, which to an extent are chosen by you and created by you, are not providing for optimal optimalism. I don't know if that's even a word. Here I go, falling apart already. But so now we have a new source of harm that is prevalent like you can't believe. And that is radiation in the form of wireless radiation. We have, you know, heard about radiation from X-rays and reactors leaking and all of that. That's ionizing radiation, thermal radiation, and that actually heats tissue. But then we've been told by the telecom industry that the kind of radiation that our cell phones emit and are all of the wireless technologies we're so addicted to, that that doesn't cook tissue and it's safe and don't worry about it. But the fact is those levels of safe, of tolerance are set so, they're so skewed. The federal government has got them millions and millions of times higher than they should be. So people can look up the Bio Initiative Report, which has set actually some even lower guidelines a couple of years ago than its original research. And those guidelines are so much below government, FCC, and again, the word is guideline. Biological effects start to happen much more readily than the government and the industry would like you to believe. So what is your body going to choose to do? It's going to either not release eggs, and this is where we get into technology having to help. So this reliance on, as they call it, medical technology to help you conceive is older than we may think. And it's pretty firmly rooted in the feminist movement and in this post-gender movement as well, because ultimately they want the state to make all the choices. And you could pick maybe the color of eyes or color of hair or maybe even the gender if you're very, very lucky. But what I learned from a guy who has a blog called thefullertoninformer.com, his name is Joe Imbriano. And Fullerton, California, he told me, is the most aggressive testing ground for Wi-Fi being introduced into the schools. And I will quote Obama from February of this year, I believe, when he said, hey, we get free Wi-Fi with our coffee. Why shouldn't we have it in our schools? So I learned from Joe. I would read his blog and talk to him on a frequent basis. But it blew me away when he told me about the zona reaction in females. And I'm paging to my newsletter that I wrote about it so I can maybe even read. But I will draw your attention to the Apple headquarters. We've all heard of Apple, right? Mm-hmm. In Cupertino, California. And if you Google Apple headquarters and look at a map of it, it looks exactly like the human follicle or egg being fertilized. If you look at it, it's a circular building complex. Now, what are buildings made of? They're made of steel and concrete, right? So they're hard. And you look down on it and you see all these wiggly, squiggly little paths going off. I don't know if they're roads or if they're paths through a park. You know, a lot of times these corporations have headquarters in like corporate parks, right? And they have nice trees and places where you can go sit on a bench, smoke your cigarette, twiddle your phone or whatever. So it turns out that the round ring of the Apple layout for the headquarters is the same as the human, I hope I'm saying this right, gamete. I meant to look it up. But that's the fertilized egg. And those paths are the different sperm coming at the egg. Now, as we know, the egg gets penetrated by a sperm. And after that, it hardens. This is what happens in human biology. This is called the zona reaction. It's a merging of the outer layers of the egg to prevent further penetration once it is fertilized. And it doesn't want, the egg doesn't want multiple penetrations. One is good enough. So it turns out that Apple headquarters is mimicking the zona reaction of eggs. Now, why is that meaningful? Well, it's possibly meaningful because frequencies, and I'm taking you back now to piezoelectricity, which I learned a little bit about. Frequencies are felt and perceived, and they translate to mechanical forces. Frequencies are not just squiggles on a chart. They are actual three-dimensional. Imagine a slinky, okay? A wave is like that. It's actually three-dimensional, and it's oscillating. It's cycling. And when a wave oscillating at billions of cycles per second hits cells and biological tissues, it is felt as a mechanical force. That's what frequency is. It translates to mechanical force. Now, our bodies and our tissues, all the minerals in our bones and the crystalline proteins in our DNA and the water in our cells, all of that is used to 7 to 12 cycles per second. This is called the Schumann resonances. It's the Earth's natural wavelength in its own natural electromagnetic field, which is like a donut that surrounds it. So we are used to seven cycles per second, maybe 12. But what are we getting from our phones? 1 billion. Many cell phones are 1.2 gigahertz. That's 1.2 billion hertz. And Wi-Fi is 2.4 gigahertz. 2.4 billion cycles per second. And these tablets, Joe pointed this out to me, if you look at the tablets, they all have the antennas at the bottom, right smack at the bottom of the tablet, where the kid or the user is pressing it against their abdominal cavity, rather. Mm-hmm. And that is right where the reproductive organs are. Now, common sense would tell you that if you're going to put an antenna into something, you should put it at the top, where it has the best chance of reaching the signal, not pressed against the body and the clothes and whatnot. But no, the antennas are at the bottom. And these, the downloads, the constantly checking for the presence of Wi-Fi, these tablets, they have Wi-Fi on all the time, even when you're not doing something. So what is that doing? Radio frequency microwaves. And they're experiencing this as penetrations, as force. And so they're hardening. So you've got all these little girls. We're born women with 400,000 eggs in our ovaries. And these eggs are hardening right from the start, as soon as these kids are using these devices. And it's in all the schools now. It's called progress. And so you're going to end up with women who are infertile, whose eggs will be so hard that they will only be penetrated with the assistance of a needle in a lab.
Wow, this is really, it's quite deliberate if you take a step back and look at this. I mean, even the use of ultrasound for pregnant women to, you know, check on the baby, or now they just have routine ultrasounds, even though, they're warned against this. But, the doctor says it's safe, even though there has been no study to prove that ultrasound technology is safe on a gestating baby. They do these scans for up to 1-2 hours sometimes, and babies in utero will actually put their hands over their ears and try to swim away. And this ultrasound, these high frequency sound waves are multiplied even more because the baby is within water. So they're getting them while they're in the womb. I've seen apps that you can buy and attachments you can plug into your phone to basically do your own ultrasound at home. There are 3D imaging booths at malls where women can go up and pay a small sum of money to have a 3D image of their baby in the womb. No one's really questioning if any of this is safe and what repercussion it has on the reproductive abilities of the pregnant woman or her baby. There has to be an effect on the sperm and the eggs of the gestating baby from using this technology so frequently and without any care. It's quite disturbing.
You know, it strikes me that they've really exploited the twinge of narcissism that we all have, because what's happening, somebody mentioned this to me a few days ago, and he said that the constant use of, or, you know, glancing down at your phone or trying to see who posted what on Facebook or responded to what you posted and who is texting me and who is emailing me now is really about narcissism. And I hadn't thought of it in that way. And so is this hunger for images. I mean, everybody is snapping images of something that they're at rather than experiencing it, you know, like a birthday party. And so, of course, it makes perfect sense that they would have walk-up booths where pregnant women can slip in a dime or the equivalent and or their credit card and have a sonogram done of their baby to get an image. And then they post it on Facebook, of course, right?
Right, of course, right so, after. And even when they're warned by other people, I've tried to show some research to pregnant women because I would want someone to tell me that. I mean, you want to keep your baby safe, and I tell them and they just roll their eyes and say, I can't wait till the next one so I can see. And I understand there is, you know, an element of fear. Is everything okay in there? And I get it. But, you know, how did we survive years ago without any of this this peeking into the womb? You know, it's not visible for a reason.
Right, of course. But they're feeding on the image craze that we're all being swept along in and partaking in. This is what I think. And of course you're going to show it's meaningless. And people see the result of an ultrasound and they don't know what it means. They have to have an expert interpret it, right?
And a lot of these experts can't even interpret things because they'll tell women, oh, your baby is 10 pounds. They'll never fit out of you. And then the baby comes out and they're 6 pounds. So it's just really pointless, and it causes a lot of unnecessary stress.
Right. But I think that it's amazing what you just told me. Now I'm going to have to think about that for a long time. But to get back to the artificial insemination and the state assisted reproduction and the whole, you know, the non-biological wombs, the artificial wombs, the no need for a mother or a father, et cetera, et cetera. They're just getting ready. They're setting us up socially and scientifically for the results of what's going to happen or what's happening to us as we are in this corridor. We're in a radiation corridor. We're riding the subway of radiation right now. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I'm just thinking, okay, if I wanted to turn off all the wireless in my house, would that really do anything? Because every single person that I'm surrounded by has a phone with wireless, and we all use this technology, and it's everywhere. There really doesn't seem to be any way to escape it, unless you're out in the middle of nowhere, I guess.
No, there are ways to escape it. For one thing, your cells undergo their repair activities during the night. So one thing you can do, and it's free and easy, is to shut off your Wi-Fi at night.
Right.
If you have Wi-Fi. So there you're already giving yourself a break, because it's a real insult to the biology to be injuring it at night. And I'm going to explain to you what a radiation researcher told me a couple of years ago, and it just never... The image has always stuck in my head. Because I said already and explained that radiation frequency is a mechanical force, when those forces hit the cells, they actually explode the cells inside. And you get this huge amount of broken material. It's called organic debris. And yes, we have 75 to 100 trillion cells. People will say, well, I can't exactly feel it. But the fact is that the smaller the organism, and let's call a cell an organism, the worse the damage is. Now, if you take a baseball bat to a whale, it's not going to feel it as much as if you take a baseball bat to a fly, right?
Right.
So on the level, the cellular level, this is where the harm is really being done right now. Those cells are being destroyed by what one person called body-shattering harmonics. And so the poor body, the cells have to detox. First of all, they have to try to survive. So the DNA is broken. It's shattered because of these frequencies. And so a normal cell or a cell can fix broken DNA properly 2 to 3 times. That's it. So if that DNA gets smashed over and over, it starts to try to repair with, and it repairs with errors after the first couple of times. So those errors, breaks in the DNA, those are called mutations. And mutations are the baseline for cancer.
Wow, yeah.
So this is how easy it is to start putting yourself at risk for cancer. And they found, this is George Carlo's research from the 90s, when the telecom industry funded him to find out, you know, cut and dry answer, is our cell phones safe or are they not? And his, all the independent researchers that he used and whose work he consulted, it all said, no, they're not safe. And all this was squashed and Carlo was vilified and lost his job and his house was burned and all kinds of things like that. But the fact is that we endanger ourselves by exposing ourselves to radiation, particularly at night when our cells are undergoing their repair cycle. A lot of people tell me they use the phone as an alarm clock. Well, you can get shielding cases for your cell phone. I actually sell them on my little website, avatarproducts.com, A-V-A-T-A-R. And they don't cost very much. And if you have to use your phone as an alarm clock, you can put the shielded side of the case toward you and have the phone on your nightstand. The phones pulse every 5 seconds looking for a tower. And I tell people, okay, shut them off. Put them on airplane mode and check your messages. But no, everybody wants to know when the message comes in or when the call comes in, right? So this is part of the whole narcissism. You don't want to miss the call.
Yeah, it's also an immediate gratification, and the same thing goes for the ultrasound. It's, I want to see now. I don't want to wait 9 months. I want to know what the gender is. And also, you know, I want to see who liked my post. I want to post these pictures of my dinner. It's all this immediate, instant gratification that we've become so accustomed to.
Yeah, and what you're doing is you're really putting your life on this two-dimensional conveyor belt, and you're showing people who aren't in your life what your life is. That, to me, is the strangest, because you'll ignore the people who are in front of you, and you'll be addressing, you're serving up tidbits to the people who are not in front of you, right?
Right.
And the other day I read on a blog a very funny comment. This guy had a meeting with a lot of, I guess, his company associates or affiliated people who had traveled from far away, some of them international, and they were sitting in this meeting room in this corporate setting, and everybody was checking their phones and texts and running out of the room to take phone calls. And finally, the guy who had organized the meeting said to everyone, he goes, look, why is, you've come all this way to have a meeting, which is human interaction, and yet you're not attending to what's at hand and having any human interaction. Why don't you all just go home, back to where you came from, and just send me a message? And that's exactly what people do. They don't live in their true present world. They are in their, what I call the second dimension, sending messages. And this, I just want to get into one more little point that I was trying to make a while ago and I forgot about. If you tell people, let's just stick with the narcissism. If you tell people, you know what, that isn't good for you. You know what, you shouldn't use a cell phone. You know what, you shouldn't have Wi-Fi or this or that. You're making them look dumb, and that doesn't fit with the narcissistic image that they have. So they don't want to hear it.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's definitely true. Definitely true. It's also kind of weird for me to see people posting images of, I understand we all want to show off our children. We're very proud and we want other people to say, oh, they're cute. You know, that's normal. And I don't think that's a bad thing, but it kind of disturbs me when I see, you know, mothers, especially, and fathers too, but mothers, for the most part, posting just pictures of their children all over the internet. And we know what kind of sick people there are out there. And I personally wouldn't feel so comfortable posting my child's image, you know, 100 times over on the internet, and, you know, and basically giving up their privacy. And, you know, they never consented to having these images posted. Some people might disagree with me, but I think it's our narcissistic culture, like you were saying, to have everyone comment, oh, so cute, oh, look, he just did this, you just did that. And I just think it's gone a little bit overboard. I don't think it's normal.
No, and in fact, I saw a little baby in a stroller the other day, and it was completely screened from the sun. It had a, there was a big sheet over the stroller. You couldn't even see that it had anything in it. But you're assuming it's a baby because the frantic parent was protecting it from the sun. So in the 3D world, in real life, you can't see these babies. But you can see them on the internet, right? That's so crazy.
Right. And parents are getting, you know, professional pictures done. I mean, you know, share them on Facebook. It's just quite weird to me.
Yeah, and then these are babies who will end up being, you know, we don't even really know what their propensities and characteristics will be like because the social engineering will muddle it so much. Because these babies are in the transhuman corridor. They're already being herded toward and into the post-human age.
Yeah, actually, something that I was looking into today, a parenting style is becoming quite popular now. There are a few different terms for this parenting style because, of course, we have to give everything multiple names to confuse everybody even more. But it's called gender-neutral parenting or gender-creative parenting, where basically the parents will give the child girl toys and boy toys and let them choose whichever one. And if the child gravitates towards the toys and clothing of the opposite sex, well, then they can wear those things. So there was this young boy in this piece I was reading that the mother referred to as boy chick because they don't like using the pronouns he, him, his. So they use gender neutral terms, and he's been given the term of boy chick. And basically he can walk around in a tutu and a dress. And if anybody looks at them weird or disagrees with this parenting style, they are just hateful people. And they're very old school. And they just don't see, you know, that this child really wants these things. And I had posted an article similar to this somewhere, and someone brought up the point, you know, if your child wants to eat cake and cookies all day, are you going to let them do that? No. And that's where parenting comes in. You tell them, you know, boys don't wear tutus. I'm sorry, they don't. Doesn't mean you can't dance. Doesn't mean you can't learn how to, you know, do some ballet moves. But boys don't wear tutus. And that's the job of a parent to set your child straight. You know, you don't have to make them feel bad about it or you know, punish them or hit them. Just say, no, that's not what boys do. And I think that these children are so confused because of the media that is being fed to them. I'm just thinking of, you know, little boys and girls growing up on a farm somewhere and they're not watching TV every day. I really doubt that they would gravitate towards, you know, a tutu. I really think it's the media and also these parents being pumped full of this garbage that they believe that this is the right thing to do. And the poor children are just utterly confused. It's so sad.
Well, can I ask you, who are the parents and where do they come from? And I just have to ask first, the boy chick, does chick mean chick like a little chick from a chicken, or does it mean girl? Chick.
I think it's supposed to mean girl.
Okay, so that you say I have a boy chick.
Supposed to mean
chick.
Girl.
So you don't tell people.
Yes.
When people say, how many children do you have? How many boys and how many girls? You say, oh, I have two boy chicks, and what's the girl called?
Chick. Well, then. Yeah, this is just a term that she came up with for her own son. So some people might just say, oh, they're gender neutral. They're not a boy or a girl. Or they'll come up with some kind of name that would express, you know, their neutrality. I personally have noticed that it seems to be mostly Caucasian white parents that are doing this. And I don't know if it's because this mind virus, which I like to call it, because I don't think it's normal. I don't know if this mind virus is being fed to white parents more, or if white parents, since they're instilled with all this guilt that they, you know, they don't want to step on any toes or do anything wrong. They just want to be so accepting. I don't know if that's why they're gravitating towards this parenting style more, I have seen a few black parents that are raising their children gender neutral, but it's mostly white feminists or a lot of the times lesbian or gay couples because they already are confused about gender roles and what a man does and what a woman does. So that's what I've noticed. And I haven't looked into it too extensively, but in my little bit of looking around and reading, it seems to be predominantly white parents and usually a feminist mother, which is no surprise there.
And it's all part of values. It's important to have these because they're, I think what they're trying to do is they're maintaining that they're giving the children the ultimate choice when they don't constrain them one way or the other growing up. Yeah, very interesting. And, you know, there was a study I'm looking at. It's the first footnote on the first page of the Hughes and Dvorsky paper. It's by B.N. Rosen and someone called Peterson concluded that the sex differences in accidental injury and death rates were related to the sex differences in activity levels, risk-taking, and frequency in engagement in rough and tumble and competitive play. So they'll use, just like they have in Sandy Hook and all these false flags, they'll use the shroud of safety. We're making the world a better place when we point out that boys break their arms more and their legs and whatever, and they sprain and fall more. So let's keep your boy chick safer by not having him do rough and tumble play and offering him a tutu or a doll.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, this is really messing up young boys. I was a nanny for two young boys, and they would, you know, I'd pick them up from school, and they'd tell me all their day, and they'd tell me how basically dodgeball has been banned, any kind of contact playing, they're not allowed to touch one another. They can't play football because someone got their feelings hurt and someone fell down and scraped their knee. I mean, they're really, I feel so bad for these boys, and no wonder they're throwing around the diagnosis of ADHD. This boy is hyperactive. He's actually normal. Boys have a lot of energy, even baby boys. They are just on the go constantly. And I know I'm jumping around here, but I really do think that circumcision, there's many different reasons for it, but I really do believe that it makes boys more docile from the start, and they're going to be less combative, and you know they're not going to be as masculine, I guess. They're not going to have that spark so much anymore. And it's really, really confusing these young boys. And I'm sure they just feel like prisoners constantly because they're not allowed to get that energy out. And I'm sure when they have to stifle that energy, it's going to come out in destructive ways. It's just, it's really not good. And then when they're giving them the option of, oh, well, you know, you can go play with baby dolls, maybe some of them are going to choose those things because they have no other options. They're not allowed to be what they're biologically designed to be. And it's really sad. I mean, even since I'm only 25 and since I've grown up, I've seen a drastic change in, you know, how boys are handled in school. When I was young, boys would get into fights and yes, they'd get in trouble, but it was, you know, that's boys being boys. But now they've really, really restricted things that boys can do. They can't play rough. They can't, you know, get into a fight and duke it out and settle it. That's how guys settle things. You know, females approach problems very differently, and they're not allowed to do these things anymore. And it's affecting how they grow up, of course.
Well, sure. I've never been a parent, but I have watched the terrors that little boys can be. And, you know, that's just part of life. Little boys are, you've got to chase after them, and they do get hurt more, but that's who they are. That's what the gender is. And it's, they play rougher games. I mean, you know, somebody told me a long time ago that sexuality is actually kind of like a spectrum, which is I guess you could say a loaded statement as I make it here. But, you know, that people range all over that spectrum. I mean, when my brother got a bicycle and I didn't, I asked my parents, well, do I get one too? And they said, you want one? And I said, yes. And they gave me one, and his was one color and mine was the other. And a few weeks later, we traded because it wasn't due to colors. I just happened to like his better. It worked differently. It was the same bike. But anyway, so I made the statement. I did ask for one because I didn't understand why I wasn't given one to start with. But this was a long time ago in a different age.
Right.
Older than you are. And, you know, then I guess I just started to be athletic. And I never was the kind of girl that wanted to, I don't know, do the doll thing too much.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's, I was somewhere on that spectrum in a different place than other little girls.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's sad. It's good in a way. I guess I can see theoretically if you want to give kids as many choices as possible, you give them as many, I guess those, the agents of choice making, you know, that's not really the right phrase, but overall, I think it's very strange what the results are going to end up being. And all that's all you and I can do, because I'll tell you, well, I shouldn't say that, that's all, but 30 years from now, it'll probably be so normal to see boys wearing skirts to school. And I think they have days when you're supposed to come in dressed in the opposite sex's clothes. Don't they have those days already?
Oh my gosh, I've never heard of that, but I honestly wouldn't be too shocked if I heard about it. It's probably, you know, some kind of tolerance exercise or embracing equality.
That.
Wow.
I'm sure they have. You're supposed
That's
to eat
really,
like casual Friday.
That's really disturbing. So the boys will wear girls' clothes and the girls will wear boys' clothes?
Yeah, which we've been doing already.
Wow.
I mean, women wear pants.
Yeah.
They wear skirts now. But that's, again, that's part of it. We have been pushed toward this end. And the end is more sinister, I think, than anyone has really even realized.
I would definitely agree with you there. And, you know, for young boys, there's just so much coming at them. I see the programming for little girls basically teaching them that they're princesses and that they can get whatever they want. And, you know, boys are stupid. I hate boys. You know, they're good for nothing. All they're good for is, you know, buying me stuff and taking me out. But with poor boys, especially Caucasian white boys, you know, they're being taught they are patriarchy and they are oppressing everybody. And no matter what they do, they will always be part of the male oppressive hierarchy. And you know, just because they're born with white skin and being a male, that they're automatically evil and they're responsible for all the bad things in the world. And that's what I see feminism preaching constantly. And they'll try and tell me, you know, since I'm a woman and I'm not a feminist, I'm just, oh, I'm awful. They'll try and tell me that, you know, women have been kept down for thousands of years and, oh, we've been so oppressed and, oh, we just want equal rights. Well, men and women are not equal and that's okay. I don't think it's normal for us to be equal because we're two different genders and we have different strengths and we have different weaknesses. But they'll say that they're all about equality when it seems to me like they're all about pushing the man down and raising themselves up and saying that they are this oppressed class when really in the Western world they have more rights than any other woman around the world. They hold a job, they can drive a car, they have many different rights and they have more privileges. I hate to use that word, but they do have more privileges than men. You're seeing more women in the workplace, in managerial roles, in high levels of government. And males are having a harder and harder time finding any kind of employment. And I believe this is all systematic. You want to get the woman out of the house. You want her to have to work to bring in an income. Then the man can't find a job, so he'll sometimes be at home raising the children. And it was brought up last night on a show I was listening to. Henrik Palmgren, who runs Red Ice Creations, was speaking on this subject and saying that in Sweden, the state will fund the father to stay home and raise the children. And what this is doing is naturally, biologically, if a man is going to be raising children and the woman is away, as an evolutionary means of survival, they'll start to produce more estrogen and they'll start to behave more like a woman because they're having to fulfill that role that the woman can no longer fulfill. So I think that, I mean, their agendas are tenfold. There's so many different agendas within one, but this is a big one here to get the woman out of the house. That was, you know, the first wave of feminism. You need to be liberated and go work because being a mother and being a house mother, a housewife is so oppressive. So they have to get the woman out of the house. Then they have to disenfranchise the males to take them, you know, basically castrate them, tell them that everything is their fault. You're good for nothing. You're a rapist. You're responsible for all the bad things in the world. And then say you want to have children. Well, the man is going to stay home and take care of them. And I've even on television, I've seen ads where it used to be the woman, you know, doing the housework and saying, oh, if only I had this good floor cleaner, or, oh, I need this new laundry detergent. Now I'm seeing ads where the father, the dad is doing the house chores and he's sitting there, oh, I wish I had a better mop. You know, so they're really, really pushing this and it's just messing everything up.
You know, to get back to something you said a while ago was men and women aren't equal and they're different and they have their different roles and strengths. Well, maybe we shouldn't put it that way. We should say men and women are just simply not the same.
Right.
They're
right.
Equal in philosophically because the weight that their different abilities and significance carries in the social structure. I mean, men can't have children without women and women can't have them without men. So they are equal. If you really boil it down, they're just mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. the same, right?
Right.
And so I'm going to call attention to a book I read. I think it was called Bread, Babies, and Bargaining Power or something like that. It was actually written by a woman who lived down the hall from me in college. And she turned out to be an economics whiz. Her name was Rona Mahoney. And she wrote this book about how if women really wanted equality in their family lives, then they needed to start marrying down instead of marrying up. Now, that is an economics term referring to how much money you make versus how much money your husband makes. And I'm just going to quote loosely from the book. This is coming from memory, and I read this book in the early 90s, I think, or mid-90s. I have it in the other room, but if I run and get it, then it'll just break my train and I'll have to get off Skype for a minute and all that. So what she was pointing out was, let's take Harvard business school graduates. That year she was writing in, the average woman graduate from Harvard Business School earned $100,000 around, right? In her first job. And the average man graduating from Harvard Business School earned $130,000 because men were and still may be paid more than women. I don't know. I'm not quibbling about that. So now she looked at the once those graduates got married, who did they marry? And it turned out that the average woman graduating from Harvard Business School who earned herself $100,000 a year married a man who earned $135,000. Hmm. And the man graduating from Harvard Business School who earned $130,000 a year married a woman who earned $30,000.
Hmm.
Okay, so the men always married down and the women always married up, regardless
right.
of where they were beginning, what their own earning power was. So Rona Mahoney argued that, okay, so what's going to happen? You have a baby, you're married, you have a baby. Who's going to stay home with the kids? The one that earns $30,000 or the one that earns $130,000? Mm-hmm. Well, it's a no-brainer. The one that earns $30,000 is going to stay home. So she said, if you women out there don't want to have to stay home with your children, then you need to marry down. Why don't you marry a man who makes $30,000 or $40,000 a year? And then he will have to stay home because it will be a no-brainer in the terms of family economics. So the gist of the book was to point out not only the patterns of mate choice in earning ability that people made or got into, but the fact that they could exercise a different kind of choice, and then they would liberate themselves if they were women. And the men would be the stay-at-home parent.
Wow. It's very interesting.
Yeah, and she used a term that I've never forgotten. It was called BATNA. It's an economics term, B-A-T-N-A. It's an acronym, and it stands for Best Alternative to a Negotiated Agreement. So here's the deal. Let's say that you and I live together. We're roommates. And you hate doing dishes, and I hate vacuuming. And we say, no problem. You know what? I'll do the dishes. You vacuum. Works out, right? Mm-hmm. But let's say neither of us wants to do the other menial job. And we both decide we hate everything. What is our best alternative? We can't have a negotiated agreement because it's not working out. Or let's say I say that I'll do the vacuuming or whatever, but you don't want to do the dishes. So we don't have any ability to negotiate through this. We're at an impasse. What is our best alternative? Well, our alternative is to do nothing, let the chores go undone and live in a hovel, or to hire a maid, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, or call in a friend, but, you know, we're going to have to, there are other ways to solve this problem. So BATNA is something that you travel the world with. You travel your life with BATNA. Let's say that I'm 45 years old and I'm divorced and I have three children who are different ages. And sure, I want to marry a man again because I'm divorced and I also would enjoy a second income and the stability and the family unit around me again, et cetera, et cetera. But the men that I'm looking for are going to look at me and go, oh, she's 45, she's pushing 50. And she has three kids. Do I want her three kids? So my BATNA is low. I don't have a lot of negotiating power in this divorce state that I'm in with these three children. So the men are not going to look to me as a partner. They're going to look for women who don't have this luggage and baggage. They're going to look for younger women who have no children. You understand what I'm saying? Who have better BATNA than I do. Because I have no negotiating power if I'm saddled with three kids and I'm single and I'm especially if I still also have to work, you know. And so she pointed out that you have to, anytime you make a choice in your life, you have to consider what is your best alternative to any negotiated agreement given your circumstances, and you want to create as much freedom around yourself as you can, or you don't set about destroying the situation you're in. That works. And so what they've done in the modern world is they have dangled all these choice carrots all around us, and people are flinging themselves at all these different options, and they're ending up with circumstances that award them very low BATNA. You know, it's dangerous to lose your family to divorce. So this is it's a reality check. To say to yourself, okay, theoretically, what are my options if I do this or that or the other? Hey, they list them in economics, so we can list them too. And all this freedom and this choice making that we're being offered is very we're going to end up being reckless and endangering ourselves.
Yeah. Yep.
And then the state and the social structure will come in with new solutions.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that's how it's been designed. So they can come in and say, oh, well, you know, we can take care of it for you. And usually they don't have our best interests at heart. It's really sad, too, in this country. It's the worst for, you know, maternity or paternity leave. women are given usually 6 weeks, and that's most of the time unpaid, and then they have to go back to work, and you have to send your child off to daycare most of the time. I mean, we're talking a six-week-old infant. This is not the time to just go dropping your child off, especially if you want to have a breastfeeding relationship. That's very demanding, and you need to be there constantly for that child, you know, during the day and during the night, and to sever that connection, to have to drop them off at daycare so the woman can go work. I think it's doing damage. Some people might disagree with me, but I don't think it's, I mean, women, you know, feminists will try and tell you that, oh, it's oppressive to take care of children because it's such a burden, and, oh, childbirth is a burden, and it's a curse, and, you know, having to take care of a child is bad, but I think that we're biologically designed to have to be very close to that infant for at least the first year or two. I don't think that it's just arbitrary or it's for no reason. I think that there's a developmental reason for this, and I think it's being messed with severely.
Well, I remember a guy once who they had their first child. He was employed at a big New York bank, and he said, it's a no-brainer. He said, my wife is going to stay home with the kid, because we would rather our child be influenced by the personality and, you know, beliefs of one of us than a babysitter or a daycare center.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
That goes for more than just the first couple of years, you know, and I think this is where we get into the birth trauma. When there is no bonding because of these protocols that they have that are so intrusive and they separate you from your baby, and, you know, I had mentioned to you that I'd interviewed Janice Barcelo. She's very good at this, dissecting all this and explaining it. But people women don't have the natural protective instinct for their children. They're that more able to put them in daycare and
release
them to the, you know, supervision of others, because they didn't bond at the right moments and in the right way when they were giving birth.
Yeah. Yeah. And this happens so, so much. It's really sad to see. And that, you know, that sets up the parental relationship for the rest of the child's life. I mean, that's the foundation. And if you can just I understand that sometimes women have had a very deep bond with their baby and they really have no other choice, you know, but to send them to daycare. And that could be traumatic for both of them. But I think a lot of the times these new modern women can't wait to get back to work. And I can understand that you really need a break. You know, it's a lot of work and you need a break, and that's totally normal. But I feel that the modern woman is just more at home in the workplace and not back with her children. It's pretty sad.
Yeah. There's the whole cachet of being a working woman versus a stay-at-home woman. That's part of the social tapestry that they've thrown around us and surrounded us with, you know.
Right.
And even just, you know, people not understanding that pregnancy has its toll on you physically. The pelvis opens up in the, I don't know if it's the 6th week or the 10th week. I think it's the 10th week. It kind of creaks and widens, and it stays that way forever.
Yeah.
That's the skeleton. You know, and so the body considers this kind of a real rite of passage. And
absolutely.
That should be part of the social consideration, but it isn't, because I've had women who've had children tell me over and over how they can't stand the way their boobs look, you know, because they nursed and they can't live with that. So they have to have a boob job. They have to have a lift. And the husbands agree. Because, you know, it does look terrible, I must say. So,
it's really sad because, you know, motherhood and giving birth and pregnancy has just become, you know, it's just so it's gross, and it's just, ugh, I don't want to go through that. So how much better would it be to just have an artificial womb? I mean, the rate of C-sections and surgical births that are going on around the world today is the first step, I believe, towards, an artificial womb. Because when you're looking at childbirth as something that is so inherently dangerous and painful, and I'm not trying to say it's not painful, it can be, but women are really strong and they can get through it. But the rate of C-sections in this country, it's 1 in 3, I believe, and I'm sure it's higher than that. In Brazil, it's 90%. So we're well on our way to permanently altering childbirth and the coming species. It's really sick, and I believe that this view of childbirth as being very dangerous and just an awful, awful experience to have to go through is even more reason for people to say, oh, well, we should have an artificial womb because then the risk of death is lowered. You don't have to go through all the aches and pains. And I think it's just an excuse to get us to accept this artificial gestation and birthing, which I don't even understand how it would work, because it's the baby that releases the hormones when they're ready to be born. So I don't even understand how an artificial womb would work. I guess you would just reach a certain day or a certain level of development, and then you would be extracted from this artificial womb. I really don't understand how it works, but the implications of these practices have really not been thought out by many people. And it's as if our humanity is slowly slipping away.
Well,
quite rapidly, really.
Again, I never designed an artificial womb, nor have I ever talked to anyone who's done so. But I would guess it's kind of like boiling an egg. And one of the things I learned from my interview with Janice Barcelo was that pregnancy is actually considered to be something like 44 weeks. And if you do the math, that's 10 months.
Yeah.
And so they tell you 9 months. And
it's not true.
Yeah, and when they do birth induction induced labor or C-sections, they're delivering all these babies early.
Premature, absolutely. It's now being said that 37 weeks is full term. If you could just look at a diagram of the brain development from 37 weeks until, say, 40, 41 weeks, the brain grows significantly. And I really do think this is being done on purpose. I don't know if it's necessarily all the time nefarious. I think, nefarious in the sense that they're doing this to alter the human species. But I think a lot of the time it's for money. It's, the convenience of the doctor. Say they want to go on vacation and they want to get this baby done so they can get their paycheck. I think that's really what it is a lot of the time. But we're not really understanding the consequences of basically picking a fruit before it's ripe, and just the kind of foundation that child has to build their life on, where they're coming into the world without any sense of control over their own destiny. I wasn't able to say this is my time, and I wasn't able to work my way out of the womb. Someone came in and induced very intense contractions that weren't naturally occurring, which they basically squish the baby because the uterus is contracting way more than it usually would. So they had no control over their entrance into this world. So what kind of life do they build for themselves? And it's not to say that humans aren't resilient, because we are. We're very resilient. And I'm not saying because you were induced, you were an induced baby that your life is ruined. But we have to look at this in the big picture. How is this altering our humanity, our future?
Well, I mean, just to extrapolate from that concept, even if your mother has an epidural and the lower half of her body is limp while you're basically on your own in your own delivery, the psyche, again, this is like the biopsyche, this thing, that term that I came up with myself. But the baby is saying, no one's helping me. I've got to do this all alone. When it's a, there's like a It's a symbiotic activity where
the mother
and the baby work together, and there's all this oxytocin. Is that what it is? Yeah, release the bonding hormone, and the mother never has a memory of the pain, but just of the exhilaration and all that. So, yeah, induced babies are fighting for their lives. They're on their own, and that's exactly how you end up becoming fearful in your own, on your own life path. Because, you know, Ida Rolf always said that emotional experiences, I don't care how old you are when you have them, you could probably have them in the womb for that matter, but they register in the tissues. They become
absolutely imprinted.
And so, as does the idea, when you're born early, you're ripping this life out, and it's not ready, and it's not going to be strong and ripe, so to speak. So it's going to be much more frail and flawed and subject to, it's coming out almost damaged because it's not ready yet.
Absolutely. Definitely. Not to mention the effect that a lot of these drugs that they use for induction have on mothers and babies. I mean, they've been proven over and over and over again that they kill mothers and babies, yet they're still being used. I mean, it just blows my mind. But I just wanted to say that, you know, the fact that a baby is, say, born at 36 or 37 weeks naturally doesn't always mean that, you know, the baby isn't ready, because every different woman and baby gestate for a different amount of time. Some women don't give birth till 45 weeks. Some give birth around 36. So every baby is different. But if you're not going into labor on your own, you know, at 40 weeks, it's not a reason to induce. It's just ridiculous. And it's really, we've been robbed of the knowledge of our bodies, both men and women, but especially pregnant women. We've been raised with all of this fear surrounding it, that it's just, it's the most dangerous thing ever. You'll never make it out alive. It's going to be just awful. And if you go into something expecting that, there's something that has been called the fear, tension, pain cycle. So our bodies are actually designed to release a nice little cocktail of chemicals or hormones while we're in labor to suppress the pain of the contractions or the birthing of the baby. So when we're going into an experience fearful and we don't know what's going on and we don't have a lot of knowledge and we're relying on someone outside of ourselves for reassurance, there's going to be pain, and it just makes sense. I don't know if birth was designed to be pain-free. I don't know. There probably is a reason for the pain, but there are women that have painless births. And I don't think that, you know, our creator, whoever that might be or whatever, would design us to have a very traumatic experience when bringing life into the world, because then why would we want to ever do it again? You know? So they've really done a number on all of us by teaching us that birth is so. Someone deliver your baby, which is just a very passive way of looking at it.
Now, you did cut out for just a few seconds there. I heard birth is something, and then you want to deliver your baby. So I'm not sure what that was, if you want to review it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was just saying that, you know, we've been taught that we need to seek assistance and pay a lot of money to have someone deliver the baby, which is a very passive way of looking at things, because, you know, no one really you can catch a baby, you can, you know, receive a baby, but by telling women that they're delivering a baby, it's taking away any sort of power or sense of accomplishment, because all the credit is going to the doctor or whoever caught the baby, when really, you know, a baby's not delivered, they're birthed, or I guess that would be the only term that would make sense. But that's something that is thrown around so nonchalantly. Oh, who delivered your baby? Where are you going to deliver your baby? Nowhere. I mean, pizzas are delivered, mail is delivered, you know, babies are not delivered. It's a very strange way of looking at it.
Babies design their own moment of arrival. See, this was a new concept for me, and it was through some of the Barcelo interviews that I learned this, and it's quite a radical, quite a refreshing concept, you know?
Yeah.
I think there's also a lot of innate information that comes to you when you're going through something like that that you didn't even know that you had or you could figure out. But they want us to abandon our bodies and relinquish ourselves to their technologies and their expertise. And you know what? I don't think it's all about money. I mean, money is nice for them, the doctors, and the convenience of whatever the legend is that they golf when they feel like it and they want to be off on July 4th, not attending some mother in 11 hours of labor. So they do things for their convenience. And yes, there is money to be made by a cesarean section. So really, though, I don't think it boils down to that. Maybe I'm just too cynical or something, but I think that the advantages that are conferred on the state long term by having human beings weakened from the, I mean, it starts in the prenatal care with the ultrasounds and the imaging and the, all of that. It's just, we're weakened and we're being deliberately weakened so that we are
absolutely
threat and force. Each one of us is diminished by all these things, and we have to work that much harder to recover ourselves and our true
I definitely agree with you there. I think a lot of the time the agenda too is to have the pregnant woman and her partner have them looking outside of themselves for reassurance and for direction, instead of saying, okay, we're the parents. We, both of us together, conceived this baby. We did this together. So why do we need some other expert to tell us what to do? I mean, the information is out there. You can educate yourself. You can know just as much as any OB or midwife out there. And who knows better than the pregnant woman herself and her partner? I think it sets parents up to not be self-sufficient and to always be looking to the pediatrician. Oh my gosh, he has a stuffy nose. Let's take him in to the doctor who's just going to prescribe antibiotics. And it sets parents up to always be looking outside of themselves for parenting advice or for how to do things, instead of the parents taking it into their own hands and saying, okay, you know, we know exactly what to do. We did this ourselves and we know our child better than anyone else. It sets parents up to look outside of themselves, and then these programs and these ideas can then present themselves and say, oh, we have the answer for you. And since they're not trusting their instincts, they're going to go with that. It's really disturbing how often I see parents ignoring their instincts because some expert says to not do that, that it's not good, you know, that your child is crying and that you feel compelled to go pick them up for the thousandth time, you know, even though it's maybe not going to do anything, but your instinct is telling you to do it. These experts will say, don't listen to your instincts. Your child's manipulating you. And it's very dangerous, I feel, to tell these parents to stifle their instinctual response to their own child. And I see it all the time.
You know, I want to go in a wild, on a wild digression here, but this really had an impact on me the other day. Do you know what the spice turmeric, or sometimes it's spelled with an R, turmeric is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do.
So it's bright orange in color. It's considered very good for you. It's a great anti-inflammatory and this, that, and the other thing. But it also has massive staining power. I mean, you eat a curry with a lot of turmeric in it and you spot your clothes and you won't get stain out easily. It'll also stain your white china and this and that. So guess what? The other day somebody suggested to me to brush my teeth with turmeric because it's the best teeth whitener in the world. I said, are you kidding? She said, no, I do it all the time. I said, really? And so if you do it, it's almost like an induction into throwing away a concept or a fear. And it's a really good practical exercise. So here we are talking about how, you know, we're given all this wrong information. And so try it someday. You make a little paste out of the turmeric powder and water. You can buy it. It comes in a spice jar. you brush your teeth with it, and boy, oh boy, this is what the natives do all over the world. They chew on turmeric root, and they have the whitest teeth.
Hmm.
And it does not stain your teeth, even though it stains your china and your clothes, and it makes those curries bright orange in color. But it is such a frightening thing to do as you do it. You think, okay, this is it. I'm just going to not be able to go out in public for a long time. But it works. It's magical. And to me, it's an exercise in trusting nature, even though it flies in the face of logic.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, that's very interesting. And that can be kind of related to the ideas of childbirth.
Yes. I mean, sometimes we have to just say, okay, I'm going off the high dive here. You should have seen how scared I was to do that the other day. But I decided to do it, and I barely knew this person who told me to do it. I said, okay, I'm doing it. What's the worst that can happen? I'll have yellow teeth for what? A few weeks? A few months? What? That's the worst? Okay. And the best is that my teeth will actually be whiter, and they are, as a consequence of that exercise. So, you know, I'm just throwing that out because we have to start debunking our quote-unquote practical knowledge that comes from a school of, I would say, sinister social architecture.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and I mean, this right here is such a big subject that can change so much, just childbirth in itself, because the video that you shared with, or I don't know if you shared it with me, but we had both watched this video that a woman put together about post-genderism and the artificial wombs. And it was interesting because the woman who made the video and who was narrating, her mother had died giving birth to her. And so the imprint that she had of birth from a young age, obviously, was that it's very dangerous and it can kill your mother. And that's awful and extremely traumatic. And this is the impact that it left on her. So she was basically saying that, you know, the artificial womb and IVF, these technologies are going to save us as a people, and they're going to prevent situations like the one with her mother from happening, when really we have to take a step back and look at a lot of the common practices that are going on in hospital births, like you were talking about induction or administering these different drugs that are proven to kill mothers and babies, or, you know, just there are so many things that get in the way of nature taking its course. I mean, just bright lights, being watched, having, you know, people checking your dilation. I mean, these things are so invasive, and they stop the natural process from happening. So instead of saying, oh, well, we're having bad outcomes, I mean, I think the U.S. is 60th in maternal and infant mortality. I mean, it's really, really bad. We're doing very poorly, when other countries that are, you know, considered third world countries have better birth outcomes than we do, there's something really wrong. And instead of saying, oh, well, that's because childbirth is inherently dangerous, no, it's because these interventions are causing problems, and we're not letting nature take its course.
Right. And they could be frequently leaping to conclusions, misinformed conclusions, based on their weird training. You know, I mean, seriously, the United States is famous for these rotations that interns go on when they're in medical school, and they're up 72 hours straight. And think about it. They're making life and death decisions. They're working in the ER, for God's sake. Mm-hmm. And they're making life and death decisions on other people while they're sleep deprived.
Yeah.
So what does this really boil down to? It boils down to the chance of making huge mistakes. And when you are that sleep deprived, you can't reason things out in your own head. You're working on rote memorization, data that you've memorized. So it's forcing them to rely on their training exclusively, to robotize them. And then also it results in making them very, very defensive and arrogant, because they know they made a mistake, They know that they hurt someone, and they've got to defend it because this is the whole hallowed, you know, hall of being an MD.
Right.
But it's really a form of mind control and of a sleep deprivation based mind control. Yeah. So in those hospitals and when you're in the care of allopathic medicine, many errors are made on you and affect you because people are being destructively trained.
Yeah.
And that's where you end up with results. I mean, the amount of, I think it's called iatrogenic, is that how you say it? That's when medicine actually harms you. I think I said it right, but I really like to check dictionaries before I spit out something that I don't say very often. But yeah, the error made by medicine itself is not an uncommon thing. It's way more common than we realize. And it's used to brainwash us into relying even more heavily on the protection and expertise of medicine.
Yeah.
You know, for instance, I have a friend who's sitting in the ER right now. Actually, she just got out. Her shoulder has been falling apart for a very long time. And she emailed me this morning and said that she was in the ER waiting to be seen. And her shoulder is excruciating, couldn't sleep all night. And so I called her up and I said, well, don't you want to go see an orthopedic surgeon or an orthopedic specialist? She said, I can't get in. You call and they tell you, our first appointment is 2 months from now. Go to the ER if you're really having trouble.
Wow.
So what are you supposed to do? What can they do for you in the ER? Except they gave her a shot of a very strong painkiller and they gave her a prescription. I mean, what else can they do? And what does that stuff do for you? It only makes you worse.
Right, or possibly. Oh,
right.
Sorry, I was going to say, or possibly develop an addiction.
Yeah, we cannot get in to get help at the proper time, and we can't wait months, and they don't want us to rely on folk medicine or the advice of friends.
Right,
and
right.
Family and our elders, they don't want us to have a body of knowledge that comes from our own tribe, you know, because that is backward and that is dangerous. But we can't see them when we need to. So
Yep. And it all starts with birth in the hospital. Because you're looking at this process as an emergency where you need professional expertise. And so that's the foundation that you start your parenting relationship on. So first sign of getting sick, you know, instead of maybe trying, I don't know, some folk remedies, like you said, or letting this cold take its course, it's go into panic mode because everything is now an emergency. And I need the white coats to come in and tell me what to do because I'm so lost and I don't have my motherly or fatherly instinct working for me. So we're constantly seeking reassurance or seeking treatment advice from someone that we put above us. And to a lot of people, a doctor can do no wrong, you know, and they know everything and they're almost superhuman in a lot of people's eyes, but they are just like any other human. And a lot of the times they're, like you said, extremely sleep deprived. And I do believe that that is done on purpose. I don't know if you've ever listened to some of Rebecca Carly's interviews that she's done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but she was a surgeon and spoke of these things, saying that they deliberately deprived them of sleep, and then they would basically ask them to do some pretty barbaric procedures. And since they were so sleep deprived and this seemed like what they had to do because everyone else was sort of pressuring them into do it, it was almost like some kind of initiation into a, you know, fraternity or cult, really. So they would do these things, and it's not good for anybody. It's very, very bad, and it's setting us on a bad course.
Well, I mean, you know, we don't even, when you go to a doctor and he tells you something really wild and crazy and nonsensical, you don't want to dismiss it. I mean, I have done so. I have dismissed medical advice in my own life. I was told by one neurologist who actually I respected very much, and it was a great guy, but he set me up for 5 autoimmune tests and blood tests for autoimmune issues and then 2 MRIs because I could have a brain tumor or a lesion on the cervical spine or some autoimmune disease when I had just this weird odd nerve thing going down my leg. And it turns out it was the whole iliotibial band area, which I didn't know about back then. And it was related to swimming and running and all that. But anyway, I just heard this and I said, oh, I'm not doing this. This is crazy. It's too close to Christmas. I don't want to go in when they're all having their parties and drinking their eggnog and I'm supposed to get 5 blood tests and these MRIs and then they're supposed to be interpreted by people who are drunk and, you know. So I just told my mother, I'm going to get acupuncture. And she was freaked out. She said, no, 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 no. And I said, I am. This is what I'm going to do. And in the end, 4 little acupuncture visits at $60 a piece solved my problem.
Wow.
But I can only imagine what I would have gone through if I had had all those diagnostic tests and the, you know, they try to err on the side of caution. They tell you, well, you could have this or this or this or this. And there are some really scary possibilities in there, you know, and much of it is just auto-suggestion too. And it comes from them trying to be careful. So I'm just telling you a personal anecdotal story. But if you disregard the advice of one doctor, everybody tells you go get a second opinion. And now they're, you know, they're raking in twice as much money and they're getting overwhelmed because one person who could have seen one doctor is now seeing 3 or 4 specialists.
Right.
And
right.
Nobody ends up knowing what to do, you know. There are one guy that I know, he was a super duper swimmer in some high school in California, and same one that Mark Spitz went to, the Olympian. And he has a terrible situation in his shoulder, and he's had to have it repaired. It's all torn now, and it's being held together with staples and stitches and screws, and the tendons that actually are attaching the muscles to the bones in his shoulder are all ripped. So they've been stapled a number of times. And he said he went to 5 of the top orthopedic surgeons in this city, which is a large city in America where I live, San Diego. And they all had 5 different ways of how they would fix his shoulder.
Wow.
5 utterly different ideas. Who do you pick?
Right, and go get a second opinion so you can be even more confused about your situation.
That's right. You go and get 5 opinions from 5 people who are rated top-notch in their field, and it's 5 different ways to do it.
Wow. The same thing goes for cancer diagnoses or treatment plans or estimated life expectancy. One doctor will tell you have 6 months. The next doctor will tell you have a year. And I don't think they can determine such things personally. I don't think there's any kind of way to even tell that. But it's kind of sad too how a lot of these alternative ways of dealing with things or, you know, even natural childbirth are just so feared and they're looked at as being negligent to your child or to yourself. It's pretty sad that it has to be that way. But I guess that's just how people see things.
Right. And I think what people don't know until they've done it a few times and they're on the other side of the road, so to speak, is when you enter that course, when you embark on that course of action and you start getting treated, this is what the medical world uses. It uses the term treatment. They're going to treat you. And what does that really mean?
Treat. It's such a treat to be, burned and cut open.
Right. But they're going to treat to me means they're going to do something to this condition, to you condition.
Right.
It doesn't carry the promise of curing you. It's not about helping you. Or they don't say, oh yeah, we know how to help you here. They say, we know how to treat you.
And that's a really good point.
Yeah. So treat just means, okay, we're going to do X, Y, and Z for this is what we've been trained to do. It may work. It may not work. If it doesn't work, we'll try Q, R, and S. And you become the guinea pig of a series of protocols that, you know, that you don't know anything about and yep. you don't really have yep. much of a say in. So that to me yeah. is something, I mean, I think people have to, if something happens to you, you should participate in your own healing. You should become
I agree.
A little more proactive rather than yeah. just surrendering yourself.
Yeah, it's becoming passive. Again, just like in childbirth, instead of saying, I'm going to give birth to this baby, it's I'm going to deliver this baby and someone else is going to do all the work for me and I have to rely on them, you know, and ask them, is this okay? Or they're going to let me do this. They're going to let me do that. The same thing goes for someone that's diagnosed with an illness or cancer. It's, you know, okay, well, what can they do for me? Instead of saying, okay, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to change my diet. I'm going to change my lifestyle. And exactly what you were saying with treatment, they're not giving you the tools to help yourself. It's we're going to try and treat you, which a lot of the times is they're not looking out for your best interest. And like you said, they are, or you are becoming a guinea pig.
Yeah.
Willingly.
What they were trained to do. Now, listen, this is a very interesting little thing that I just remembered. I was walking on the beach years and years ago, and I fell into step with this woman who was probably in her 60s. And we just started talking, and she told me her husband had been very ill, and I can't remember what it was. And he had been operated on, and the surgeon was a really great man, very talented, and they had all kinds of confidence in him. But, you know, in the beginning, they were worried, both her husband and she was worried as well. And at one point she said to the surgeon when he was describing, well, we're going to do this. And then, you know, if that doesn't work, we'll do this and on and on. And she looked at him and she said, oh, well, that sounds great. But should we worry about anything? Should we worry? And he said to her, worry is optional.
Hmm.
And, you know, at that time, I thought it was a brilliant statement, a really lovely move on the chessboard by him. But if you really inspect it for what it could be, it might just be more of that, don't worry, it's optional, let us handle it, you know?
Yeah.
So he was right. Philosophically, yes, worry is optional and it doesn't help necessarily. But sometimes you worry because that's your own kind of beacon going off inside mm-hmm. you saying, well, you know, maybe I should look into this a little bit. So now I interpret that statement a little bit differently now mm-hmm. that I know more about the medical field and the way that they train and what they do and how they do it and what they rely on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I have to say this for in defense of our medical establishment and allopathic medicine. I spoke once to a very talented ER doctor, and I'll actually quote her, Dr. Tenpenny, Sherry Tenpenny. She's quite a name in the vaccine field. She's a very good vaccine activist and very highly regarded. And I asked her, I don't know what I was exactly asking her, but she pointed out to me that allopathic medicine is actually very, very good in acute situations when you need intervention and
right.
you need, you know, technology has a lot of things going for it. You break your leg, a hospital is going to be a place where they very
yep.
well could help you better than anyone else. You need a bypass surgery or whatever, they can do it. But for chronic conditions, they just aren't good at all. They don't know how to deal with chronic situations. And the things that they prescribe, pharmaceuticals and whatnot, no good. For diagnostics, they can be pretty good too, because they have machines that can look into you. Of course, we have to be very careful about how much of that you use, because it's radiation-based, a lot of it. But anyway, acute situations, allopathic medicine can be a very good place to go. Chronic situations, no, but guess what? homeopathic, naturopathic, alternative medicine tends to be much, much pathic. So you have to, the avenue is split, and you go on whatever side of it fits your situation.
Right. I totally agree. I don't think it's wise to throw it all away and say, oh, you know, good, and we need to go all the alternative route. Because like you said, allopathic medicine absolutely has its place. And if I got in a car accident and my leg was dangling by a string, I'm definitely going to go to the hospital. I'm not going to go home and try to, you know, put some essential oils on it and hope that it, you know, gets better. But again, it shouldn't be an all or nothing thing. And even to go back to childbirth, sometimes there are emergencies, legitimate emergencies, where a C-section is actually necessary. And I'm never trying to say that, oh, every birth should be just wonderful and perfect and beautiful, because it doesn't always look that way. And sometimes it is necessary for a surgical birth, but it is being overused, just like allopathic medicine in itself is being overused, and it seems to be the only thing that people really know about, and it is respected more than some of these folk remedies or homeopathic remedies, which is, you know, it's a fine balance, just like anything. Too much of one thing is never good enough to do.
Right, and I think one area of confusion now is that we're not dying so much from infectious disease anymore, bacterial issues, microbial issues. We're really falling apart. We're suffering from degeneration, both neurological and systemic. Autoimmune failure and dysfunction is a consequence of the body's innate functionality failing and degenerating. And it can get worse and worse over time. So these comprise our chronic issues today, degenerative disease, and yet we turn to allopathic medicine when it is often, you know, from a lack of, first of all, protection. We aren't shielding ourselves adequately from sources of injury like radiation, wireless particularly, and we don't seek out proper nutrition. We don't understand the meaning of organic food. I mean, it's really very simple, but chemical pesticides sprayed on plants go into the soil, and so that's what all these generations of plants in these fields are growing from and out of. They're growing out of chemicals, chemically tainted soil. So if you buy lettuce, if you buy anything that's sprayed, then what are you really eating? I mean, it is a no-brainer when it's explained that way, but you know, people make all these issues about how organic food is more expensive and I'm not ready for it yet. I can't afford it. That's how I used to be. I used to say I'm not spending the extra pennies on organic because I thought of myself as poor. This is how I thought. This is how my picture of myself was, no, I can't afford that extra 25 cents or extra dollar. But the fact is you really can. And it is going to make a difference in the long run, and one that, you know, will keep you a lot richer in terms of your own structure, you know. You can't pay for that when at a certain point.
Right, exactly. Or just, you know, looking into growing your own food, or, you know, educating yourself about where these things are coming from and what things are good for your body and what aren't.
Well, yeah, and it sounds like you may need to attend to this little baby that I hear, which just, we have to thank him. He's the perfect sound effect for the show.
Yeah. I just put him down. He just needed to eat a little bit.
Well, I hope he had a very welcome delivery to life. And here I went and used their word entrance, arrival.
Yeah. It was the only way that I thought, you know, would be good. You know, I personally was a C-section baby, so I think that I've carried around this sense of not being able to finish things with me throughout my life. I do believe that my C-section was unnecessary, and I'm not going to go and, you know, convince my mom of that. But just in my, you know, research of childbirth and educating myself, I do believe it was unnecessary. And I think that's why I carried around that sense, and so I made up my mind that I didn't want to continue this cycle and that I wanted to stop it. And, you know, I haven't ever really shared my story on air. Maybe I will at some time, but to make a long story short, like you know, Sophia, I gave birth without doctors or midwives and no prenatal care, and I relied all on myself and my partner. And I'm not going to say that it was easy because I had a hard time, but I did it, and I think that other people can too. And I think that it's important to have a sense of community, especially to be able to ask our elders or other women and men that have gone through these things, to ask them for their experience instead of relying on one person who, you know, is supposed to give you all your information. And since, you know, the internet is so readily available, it's important that we seek out all kinds of information. You know, and I know it can be a bit confusing because for every article that says this is bad, one will say it's not. But I don't know. I think it's good to have a healthy level of skepticism always and to question everything and to never just take things at face value.
Yeah, well, I think that was very, very amazing of you to have accomplished what you did and the way that you did. And maybe someday you'll write a book about it, or I don't know. It's these kinds of journeys are very interesting, and I think people should share them however they end up. You know, there was a film I saw called Pregnant in America. The filmmaker's name is very long and difficult to pronounce, but it was really hilarious. He has an amazing talent at filmmaking, and it was a documentary, very mm-hmm. much like, you know, The Business of Being Born, I think. Yeah. And he and his wife chose to have their baby at home. And there's a twist at the end that's very unexpected. They didn't plan this at all for it to end up this way. I'm not going to give away what the twist was. But in the end, it came out a really, really sort of real life adventure with a surprise ending and all, you know. And that's how it is. We never know where we're going to end up. And as I have always said, one of my favorite sayings is, a straight line is the quickest way to the wrong place. So life is a zigzag, and so is your education, and so is your experience. And I think it's best if we're in charge of that ourselves, and we make that decision from our, you know, instinct and our community influence and the people we seek to have some kind of basis in the third dimension with real people around us and work out of that. That to me is the most important thing. But how many people don't even have that?
Right. Yeah, I completely agree. I know exactly the documentary you're talking about. It's really interesting, so I recommend anybody, if they're listening, to go watch it. You can watch it for free on YouTube. And it also shows the differences in our countries and our views on these topics. But I think the fact that we've been so separated from having any kind of homogenous community or just any kind of community that has multiple generations within it. You know, a lot of us have had to move away from our hometowns, or that, you know, our hometowns aren't even appealing to us anymore, that we've all kind of scattered around the world and we have no real roots set up anywhere. And I think that that is super important to base or to create our ideas and our views of the world, and to have a sense of being able to fall back on a group of people, or being able to rely on somebody, or having close connections, because I think a lot of us live in isolation with no sense of, you know, who our neighbors are. Or I could go call up my neighbor right now and have him come over. And some people do have that, and that's great. But a lot of us are very isolated, and we don't have those communities with the elders and our family anymore. And I think it's very important to rebuild that, even if it's not blood relatives. You know, I think
I know. I agree with you. In fact, one of the things my mom used to tell me, and it would infuriate me, and I think this was just part of the way that her generation was socialized, but I'd come home and I'd say something, you know, somebody I ran into and such was going on with them, and my mother would just look at me and she'd put a hand up in the air and she'd close her eyes and shake her head and she'd say, you know, just don't get involved. And she said this to me all the time, don't get involved, because getting involved is too human, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And anyway, it might be good advice, it might not be, but I always chose to dive in and get involved in trying to help other people surmount a problem. But that's really what the whole community thing boils down to, I think, getting involved. Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's what I see, you know, doing podcasts like this, or, you know, each of us interviewing each other and talking to each other. I think we're slowly building that community virtually at first. And that's just fine because we are all scattered and this is a big world. And but the like minds seem to be coming together in our quest for truth, as cheesy as that might sound. But that's really what we're all after. We just want to know the truth and we want to know the best way of living and just to be happy. And I don't think that's too much to ask for. So,
right. And even to phrase it a little bit differently, it may not even be truth. It may be that we are seeking to know and rebuild the world. And that's
what
we're doing, talking to each other. We're really discovering and rebuilding a world that we like, and we like it this way.
Yeah. I like that even better, actually.
Yeah.
Well, we are coming up on 2 hours now, and I just wanted to thank you again for this conversation. It has been really awesome to finally get to chat with you for a while, and hopefully it's not the last of these get-togethers, and hopefully we can discuss some more topics in the future, because I think that you have so much to share, and I would love to talk to you again. So, thank you very much for joining me today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. And once again, I hope you didn't expect a super technical talk referring to that awful paper, which anyone can read and their eyes will roll as yours were, as you told me when you began to read it. But yeah, the technical papers are out there, but I'd rather just get into a chat like we had. So thank you. It was wonderful. I really appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. And I hope that everyone listening enjoyed it. I know I did. So thanks again, Sophia, and I will be talking to you soon.
You're very welcome. Goodbye.
Bye.
That song, I'm thinking something along those lines of.